say that the moon would be, you know, on the opposite side of Earth. But, you know, again, the spacecraft would be at that same 250,000 mile location again. But this time the moon will be, you know, coming up, pulling the spacecraft back to it. And if you don't get that, I'll have to send you a diagram. I do have a diagram there.
Yeah, well, let me make a guess. So I have the impression that TESS is in a polar orbit around the Earth. It's a highly elliptical orbit. One time when it's at apogee, the moon, if you're looking at everything top view, the moon is at 9 o'clock during one of the apogees of TESS. During the next apogee of TESS, the moon is at 3 o'clock. And TESS is in a highly elliptical orbit going over the north and south pole of the Earth. And the apogee is getting close to the moon's orbit. Is that approximately what this TESS orbit is, Lloyd? I mean, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good way to explain it. Let's say you had two hula hoops, you know, and you had them, like, combined with each other. Take one hula hoop and turn it at 90 degrees, you know, and leave the other one alone. Call the one that you left alone the moon orbit, and that test is the other orbit. And then the part that you're holding in your hand is now the Earth, you know. It's a highly elliptical orbit, so, you know, it's not circular, but you know what I mean. Back to you there. Yeah, you got it right.
Unusual. W-H-O-L-Y-Y. You've got it, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. W-H-O-L-Y here. I didn't hear this topic covered, and I heard this clip on the news this week. Some sort of space probe is going to be sent towards the sun. I don't know exactly when it's going to happen, but it's coming up very shortly. And they said the speed of this thing, and I listen carefully. I'm not sure as it approaches the sun or during its travels, this probe, which will have a shield in front of it to keep it away from the sun's heat off of it, because it's going to be, I think, within a million miles of the sun that's going to orbit it. And it's about 2,500 degrees. But they said the speed of this thing is going to be something like 430,000 miles per hour, 118 miles per second. And I can't believe you can get something going that fast. Is that simply because of gravity of the sun, or is something else going on with this particular spacecraft? Back to you.
I think you've discussed this with us a couple of weeks ago, Paul. Over to you, Paul. What's the name of that thing? And I think it has to do a couple of flybys of Venus and Mercury in order to get into its final solar orbit. And it's very close to the sun. I think it's inside of Mercury's orbit, if I remember. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, way inside Mercury's orbit. Just under 4 million miles from the surface of the sun. So I think Mercury is what? Is it 80? Was 80, let's see. Trying to remember Mercury's orbit. I've been talking about that recently. But by the way, this is called the Parker Solar Observatory. And yes, we did cover it a couple of times. And it's going to be getting, when it gets near the sun, it's got this carbon-carbon material, the same stuff that used to be on the nose of the space shuttle. Reject the heat of the sun, and they have solar panels, which are going to be, there's going to be actually fluid going through the solar panels to try to keep them cool when they're getting that close to the sun. And 400,000 miles an hour, I haven't heard that one yet. It's probably going to get faster than the Helios. We had Helios, which never got that close to the sun, but the Helios missions back in the 70s, I think they got up to 140,000 miles to the sun. So, 140,000 miles per hour. So, it's relative to the sun. So, it's going to be moving really quick. So,
Parker
Observatory, and that should be launched. I have the date here somewhere. But it'll be going up this year. Without looking, I'm going to say August, but give me about 1 minute, I'll figure that out. Back to you, Dick.
I think Earth's orbit around the sun is at 93 million miles. I'm not sure, but I think Mercury is 53 million miles. I think it's got an 88-day orbit. And because of that universal law, that distance cubed equals period squared, when you work that formula backwards, and you know that Mercury's got 88 days and Earth's got 365 days of orbit, you can therefore figure out what's the ratio of distance from the sun. And I think it turns out, if I didn't make a math error, it's 53 million miles. And so if this satellite you're describing is only 4 million miles, I presume, is that distance from the center of the sun or the surface of the sun? The sun is almost a million miles in diameter, so that makes a big difference. But boy, that thing is close. And that shield that keeps it from melting is going to have to do an awful lot of hard work. So you just told me the name, and I've already forgot it. The name of that satellite is what, Paul? Over to you, Paul.
Parker, you know, P-A-R-K-E-R, named after a living guy that was heavily involved with the sun. They usually wait for somebody to die, but not this guy. He was some big-time scientist. And they're going to launch it on the Delta IV Heavy. Now, this is an extremely large rocket, right? And yet, Parker Solar Probe is only going to be, you know, maybe 1,000 pounds or something. Meanwhile, we're using our heaviest vehicle to do it. And the idea is to, eventually, it's going to do some flybys and try to, you know, actually try to slow it down a bit. So it's going to be interesting. And it's I'm off by a day. It was July 31st. I thought it was August 1st. July 31st. So will be the launch from Cape Canaveral. And when I say the Delta IV Heavy, that's three Delta, full, you know, big Delta rockets bolted together, you know, similar to what we saw with that Falcon 9 when that went up. That had the three boosters. Well, this is the same type of deal, except it's the Delta IV. And they run these big RS-68 engines. There is the whole thing is hydrogen and liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen for the fuel for the system. So I'm looking forward to the Parker mission. It should be good. Back to you, Dick.
So what made you interested in the Parker satellite? I guess the main thing that you were amazed is that extremely high velocity. I'm going to work that one out, too, to make sure it makes sense. So did the rocket really move it that fast? I think in the process of it diving toward the sun and doing some flybys of Mercury and Venus, I think that's how it built up that speed, Joe. The V2LYY, V2LAW, and the TechNet.
Well, yeah, I just saw this as a clip on the news this past week, sometime in the morning, or one of the three or four days ago, or something like that. And I figured I'd just ask about it, because I don't remember Ben covering it the last time. Maybe he did, maybe I didn't hear it, but I just thought that speed was kind of tremendous, and I kind of thought maybe gravity has something to do with it, because you had said in the past that to propel something that fast, it becomes exponential as far as how much fuel you keep on needing to be able to add to your speed and so forth.
The actual measurements that satellite intends to take, I think they're trying to get a lot more information about what the surface of the sun is like, and why is the corona so much hotter than the photosphere. So I bet you there's a bunch of crazy telescopes and a whole lot of instrumentation that's going to be making those measurements. Over to you, Paul, for comments on that.
Oh, yeah. What fascinated me was the cooling system that they're going to use for, but it's solar panels. Before it gets near the sun, they'll just have regular solar panels. But as it gets closer, they need to produce 400 watts for to operate this thing. And without this cooling system, whatever light coming off the sun, it would be too much. It would fry the panels. So they actually have this active cooling system within the panels. I'm not sure what they're going to use as a refrigerant, probably ammonia, but I don't know for sure. And I don't think it's going to be an evaporative type of system. I would imagine it's just going to be flowing fluid using a pump, similar to what they do on the space station. But I guess all those details will come out later, maybe another month or so from now. So, back to you, Dick. I had one story about that Europa lander, but that's a long way from now. That won't land until 2031. But now they're working on a Europa lander, because you asked about that again last week. So I got some more information about that.
Fuck you too, Nate.
Okay, now, let's see if Joe, you have any further questions, Joe, before I ask Paul some questions about the Europa lander, the B2RYY, K2RIW?
No, I had a question I was thinking of, but it has nothing to do with the space report, but I can wait to table that till like next week, since you got 45 minutes or so to go, or 40 minutes to go.
Repeater, timeout.
Out of curiosity, what's the subject matter of your question that you're holding on to?
Okay, scientist always wants to know. Okay, well, it basically is like this. I forget how they worded this question, but they said I guess it's part of a cesium atom, which is what they use for timing on these GPS satellites, and the transition is something like 9 billion counts, and that's how they internationally define 1 second. It was 9 billion, 800 million, something like that. My question on that is, how do they count that? What instrumentation they use to actually count this transition going on within this atom to come up with that figure and call that 1 second worth of time? Because that's supposed to be internationally recognized as one second now.
I'm guessing they set up a cesium beam oscillator and then use a frequency counter on it to come up with that roughly 9 gigahertz rate at which the cesium beam oscillator runs. And so 9 billion and some number of million oscillations is now the definition of 1 second, measured by way of the transition frequency, I think they call it, of a cesium beam. So at that frequency, it's transitioning between two different modes of operation of an oscillating system. That's my vague understanding of it, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Okay. You said they use a frequency counter. How do they set that frequency counter to know that it's accurately counting that count? Where does its time base come from?
Yeah, that's a goodie. Somebody's got a precision 10 megahertz oscillator somewhere. And how do you know the 10 megahertz oscillator is right? Well, you use the National Bureau of Standards. Well, how do you know the National Bureau of Standards is right? Well, the National Bureau of Standards developed the cesium beam oscillator. It's a great big cycle. So, where's the basement of this building, of this structure that's... where's the bedrock of frequency measurement? How do you know really what 1 second is? I think 1 second used to be defined as some percentage of the orbit of the Earth around the Sun in the old days. And now they slowly discover that the Earth's orbit around the Sun has slowly changed, and that's why we've got leap seconds every so often. So where is the real beginning of all this frequency measurement is what you're asking, Joe. And so maybe we're going to have to ask Roy that question in the future. That's a tough one. Over to you, Roy. Where's the beginning of frequency measurement? W-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W?
I know it starts something.
AC2GS, why would you need a timestamp? All you need is a frequency count and wait until you get to 9,192,631,770 cycles, and that time interval is a second.
Agreed, but the question Joe is asking is that we've determined that 9 and a fraction gigahertz of oscillation of a cesium beam is defined as 1 second. We measured that with a frequency counter. What did you use to calibrate the frequency counter?
I guess another time standard, and then you fudge the numbers and proclaim that this is the number that really counts. Because all these things are arbitrary. There's nothing special about a second, unfortunately.
But it's internationally recognized as 1 second is that definition, like you just said. As I read that on one of these different websites, I was looking, coming through different things, and that is, you know, a day, a month, and so forth is multiples of a second, but internationally 1 second is recognized by this measurement. And it goes back to the question of how do you make that measurement accurately? Where do you get the instrumentation accuracy from?
Again, it's kind of chicken and the egg-ish. Once you've agreed upon this amount of alternations, you have the time. How you figured out that this was the number of fluctuations that should be a second, it was probably based on yet another time standard before everyone agreed on this time standard.
Yeah, we've had a definition of 1 second. How much time is, how many milliseconds, microseconds, nanoseconds is 1 second. We've had that definition for lots of decades. And so, however that was established, they made sure that this new definition by way of a cesium beam agreed with that. And so because it's a more accurate method, it's now the standard as opposed to whatever previously was considered the standard. That's what I think took place. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, this is just primarily a historical question as opposed to a scientific one because all the units are arbitrary. I mean, the reason why the clock is in these 12s and 60s and strange numbers goes back to the Babylonians who really had a thing about base 12s and such. So that's why we have 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in an hour and 12 hours in a half a day and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, there's always standards, and they have to be internationally agreed upon. Otherwise, you get a lot of trouble. So every so often, everyone sits down and agrees. Up until very recently, there was a weight in France that was the kilogram. It was, you know, the primary kilogram. There was nothing special about it. You took it out, you weighed it, and that was a kilogram. And obviously, someone decided that we needed to... else, and so they're trying to come up with a more technical way of describing mass than just a bar that sits in a lab in France.
Yeah, I think the standard of a kilogram is a super smooth silicon bowl of a very precise diameter. Is that what's become the new standard, Roy?
That's the most recent one. If you go back just 10 years ago, I think it was basically a bar. I forget if it was platinum or something nice like that. And it was under glass, and they had, I think, about three or four different sister bars as weight standards. And unfortunately, they decided to measure them, and they found that the weights were changing over time. So that's where they came up with the silicon bowl. But ultimately, they're going to have to describe it as the mass of a certain number of moles of a standard element like carbon 12 or something. So that's the inevitable conclusion to the internet standardization of mass. And everyone's looking to standardize everything with test equipment so that you don't have to go running over to France to weigh a bar or sphere.
Good stuff. And another point I was going to make along these lines, but I forgot it. Paul, back to you. Did I have a further question for you? Tess is going to be measuring a much, much bigger section of the sky simultaneously, looking for exoplanets. So where we've got 3,000 or so exoplanets right now, I guess that number is about to be multiplied by quite a bit in the near future, isn't it, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, and I'll be looking for a couple of thousand possible candidates. That's what they become, and then they eventually confirm them. And by looking at 90% of the sky, only to 400 light years out, should be interesting. They'll be relatively close by. We'll be looking at a lot of red giants, because the planets that they'll be looking for will probably be close in. They'll be staring at the same spot in the sky for roughly 27 days total. You know, you've got this whole thing figured out. But that means they're looking for short orbits. Now, to find a short orbit, they want to find it in the Goldilocks zone. To get that, you can't look for a big bright star. You have to look for the cooler ones, like the red stars. The cooler ones. So they want to find Earth size or Neptunian size, you know, somewhere between our size and Neptune would be ideal. And they're going to use these four cameras. And the guy had, I think he was the principal investigator, he had a lens in his hand. And he said, this is one of the lenses. Well, he said, this isn't the one, you know, I got my fingerprints on it now, but it looked like about 4 inches in diameter. Let me drop it. And these four cameras will be running the whole time. And what they're doing is the spacecraft will be on the way out to the lunar orbit, and then we'll be coming back. That's when these cameras will be taking pictures. When it gets closer in, like around 6,000 miles away from the Earth, the deep space network is going to point to the spacecraft, and it will be downloading all the information that it got. And it's going to take, I think they said, I think it was 10 or 12 hours or something of download time, and then the rest of the time is dedicated to taking pictures and looking for planets. So, I wanted to say something about Tess that I thought was important. Now, when I'm out of my head, let me think about it.
On the subject of very accurate clocks, there was a report recently about these new clocks that are even more accurate than cesium. I forgot what the material is. Anyhow, the new clock, if you build a pair of them, and I think they're good to one part in 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 13 in frequency accuracy. You got these two clocks side by side, and you got them running at the exact same frequency. So they act like they're locked to each other, even though they're independent. And you pick up one of the clocks and hold it a few feet higher than the other clock. You will see that the clock you're holding higher is now running faster because it is a few feet further away from the center of the Earth. It is that sensitive to space-time, if you know what I mean. So when you get these super accurate clocks, they become an ideal altimeter. Over to you on that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW, have you heard that one?
And that goes back to the same question I asked. If they're making those kind of precise measurements, how is it being done? With what instrumentation?
I think you're alluding to an erbitium element timepiece, which is even more efficient and accurate than cesium. Cesium's been around since 1955, and Up until cesium, it was purely the rotation of the Earth or the calculated rotation of the Earth. So my guess is that they tested the ertibium clock on the old cesium clock and just decided on an extra digit or two of, to calculate things. But that's the nature of things. You make the best measurement you have, and then you agree upon it, and you move on from there.
Didn't they want to use pulsar at one time? WSN.
I don't know. That would be sort of messy. I mean, what would happen if it just shifted a little bit?
Which they do. Let me drop. Yeah. A pulsar is a neutron star, an extremely heavy, very compact object rotating. So it's got a huge amount of moments of inertia. Therefore, its rotational period is extremely constant. So by measuring pulsars, they used to think you'd have a very accurate clock. Except, every so often, a pulsar goes into a kind of an earthquake where the material in the neutron star settles to a lower altitude, and so by conservation of angular momentum, it suddenly spins a little bit faster. So they found a pulsar that they measured over a period of time. It was extremely accurate, and all of a sudden, it made a digital jump to a slightly higher frequency. So they suddenly realized that that may not be good enough. I bet you've heard about that one, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, and but also I think it's a lot easier if you have a time standard that you can put on a table someplace as opposed to needing a telescope to figure out what time it is.
Now, to answer one of your implied questions, Joe, sometimes the comparison is a bit spooky. Say, for instance, you and I built an oscillator that we think has got extremely high spectral purity. In other words, the residual FM of this oscillator is very, very low. Let's assume the oscillator is running at 10 gigahertz. And how do you measure spectral purity? Well, you put that oscillator into the equivalent of a spectrum analyzer and measure its side lobes. Measure how wide the signal is on a well-calibrated spectrum analyzer. Well, the well-calibrated spectrum analyzer, it has internal oscillators that's running its superheterodyne system to beat it down to a lower frequency, to notice to measure the bandwidth, so to speak. So now, the spectral purity of the oscillator in the spectrum analyzer becomes part of the measurement of the oscillator you're measuring. Therefore, you give up by that approach. You assume that your super high spectral purity oscillator, let me drop. You assume it's an extremely good design, that you're able to duplicate it exactly. Therefore, you build a pair of your super good oscillators, and you beat them against each other into a mixer, and look at the residual side lobes of that. So, the standard of a super high spectral purity oscillator is to build a pair of them. If you have any doubt that the pair are not identical, you build a third one and compare each of the first two to the third one. Sounds like a house of cards, doesn't it, Joe? W2RYY, K2LAW.
Yes, it does. It does sound like a house of cards. It really does. And it all gets down to, I guess, what Roy said. I guess you just make a measurement and go on. But it is curious how you keep on doing these things, and like you said, they come up with something else. And I thought a cesium oscillator was surpassed with rubidium as far as accuracy, even though it's been around for a while. But maybe I'm wrong on that.
Rubidium, the good news about rubidium is it has very low spectral purity, very low residual FM, but it does drift. Cesium is not good on residual FM, but it's got a much, much lower drift. So use cesium for exact frequency. Use cesium for exact frequency in the old days, and rubidium is a popular oscillator that you and I would be using. But now, this new one that Roy just told us about, I forget what the material is. I think it's exceeding cesium by some significant amount. Isn't that what you've heard, Roy? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to pronounce. Ytterbium. It's an optical oscillator. It doesn't operate microwaves. It operates about 100,000 times faster than the cesium oscillates at. And so its accuracy is that much better.
And then do we count that down in order to compare it to the cesium?
Yeah, there's a down conversion as well. I don't recall what the number is, but it's ridiculously high.
What's kind of amazing to me is that if that thing runs some huge number higher than cesium, which is 9 gigahertz, the fact that you can build a down counter, a binary counter, running at that frequency without missing counts, that to me is kind of amazing.
Yeah, science is great, eh?
Because we didn't have frequency counters in the old days, you couldn't measure frequency. You couldn't count that high. Therefore, you measured wavelength. Your lecture wires, measuring Viswas on a pair of parallel lines and measuring the peaks and valleys of your standing wave ratio, you measured wavelength. That's why we call it the 20-meter band and the 15-meter band. So for quite a few decades, we couldn't measure frequency. We measured wavelength. And most of the optical stuff, we don't talk about the 10 to the 15 hertz of a optical, you know, a green laser, 10 to the 15 hertz. We talk about 550 nanometers. Oh, dear Roy. So we can't count light yet. So we're still measuring wavelength there. Oh, dear Roy.
Yeah, all this history is great. I mean, what I found amazing is, and I'm very glad that they made it illegal to use a spark gap generator, because I'm sure there are some guys who think that you're only a true ham if you're operating spark gap. But that was before they had tuned circuits. That's before they had amplifiers. Can you imagine the mess that must have done to the electromagnetic spectrum?
Some of those very early strong spark gap generators on land stations and on ships ran numbers like 250,000 watts of spark gap. Wow. That must have been noisy and smelly.
Yes, I've heard people who have kind of redone the spark gap for historical purposes, and the noise drove them crazy.
So the spark gap itself, you'd have to put that into some kind of a soundproof enclosure just to be able to tolerate all the noise it's making. And when you're putting that much power across the spark gap, no matter what you make those electrodes out of, you're slowly eating them away. You're electroforming them and turning them into dust. So they've only got a finite number of hours that you can use them.
Yeah, I haven't seen any in real life, but I assume they kind of screw along. So every so often you add an extra millimeter here, an extra millimeter there.
Trying to think of the guy's name, W2KRM. Hmm. Good buddy of mine, all of a sudden I can't think of his name. He likes antique equipment. And so he has given demonstrations at ham clubs where he has a real spark gap transmitter and you let it operate and show people how noisy it was. At ARRL, they had a spark gap transmitter. And during my visit there 20-some-odd years ago, they did me the honor of letting me hear my call letters being sent over a spark gap transmitter. Wonder if you've ever been near a spark gap transmitter, Paul. WS2N, K2IW. George Flanagan, by the way, W2KRM, George Flanagan. He's a guy who really likes antique equipment. You've got it, Paul.
No, I haven't. I've seen pictures. I've seen how it works. You can hear the noise when you're watching something either on TV or on YouTube. You don't realize how loud it is until you would be in person. So why couldn't they take that spark and then put a big globe around it and pull a vacuum on that stick? Wouldn't that be a good way to go? You know, it was inside of a a vacuum chamber. Maybe it wouldn't be making all this noise.
G2 online.
All right, we'll get to you in a second. The trouble with a vacuum chamber is it's not going to draw an arc. It's the air breakdown that makes the arc. So if you've got a perfect vacuum, you don't have an arc and you're not making a transmitter. Mr. R.I., give us your full call letters and your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, K2RIW from KG2RY, name is David. In order to measure the frequency of a spark gap generator, they have to use a certain length of antenna, right?
Yes and no. In the old days, because you didn't have a frequency counter, you measured wavelength. So, yes, the spark gap transmitter has either a resonating coil and or the antenna. The combination of the loading coil, let's call it, and the antenna does give you a resonant circuit. So although the spark gap is a very broad band frequency-wise transmitter, it does have a frequency where most of the power is located. So when you use your electrowire standing wave ratio thing, you find out what is the primary wavelength, and you come up with numbers like 10 meters and 20 meters and 40 meters. So in those days, you could measure wavelength, even though it was a kind of a fuzzy number, because the thing was for down broadband. Over to you, David, K2RIW.
K2RIW from KG2RY. Yeah, I remember going up to W1AW in Newington, Connecticut. They did a demonstration of their spark gap transmitter. And they told us that, you know, they were transmitting on long wave. You know, that it would basically cover the whole band. I mean, I guess it depends on how close you are to the transmitter. But they caused a lot of havoc on the airwaves. Go ahead.
Yeah, the good news is that in the days when you didn't have an amplifying device and a final tube for the transmitter and so on, the only way you could create power is with that spark gap. That's the only way you could create a high-frequency oscillation. The negative impedance, the negative resistance, the negative impedance of the arc, when put across a resonator, which is the loading coil and the antenna, gave you an oscillating frequency. It gave you an RF frequency that you could transmit. The modern day equivalent of that is a gun diode. A gun diode is also a negative impedance device, and you put it across a cavity. It will cause the cavity to oscillate. So a gun diode oscillator is kind of broadband, nowhere near as sloppy as a spark gap. But in those days, you had no amplifying device. The only way you could transmit an RF wave is with that spark. It's the only thing you had at the time. By way of vacuum tubes that came along and gave you the ability to build real clean oscillators and real clean power amplifiers, life got a hell of a lot better. And instead of being a transmitter that filled up the whole 40-meter band, you now could be on a specific frequency. Over to you, Gary, K2RIW. I mean, David.
QSL, and also, you know, that could, with more advanced technology, they could start using, like, radio telephone and amplitude modulation, but it's kind of funny where it all comes from.
We've come a long way. No matter where you, if you could go back in time, and you looked at what they were using then, by modern standards, it seems kind of crude, but that's all they had. It's been a continuous development of electronic devices. And so you and I can look at a computer today and look at how elaborate that thing is. And you could easily say, boy, that's kind of magic. That couldn't have happened by accident. There must have been a deity that did that. Well, in reality, what you and I call a modern-day computer represents something like 50 years of continuous improvement. When you keep improving some kind of computing device for 50 years, pretty soon it gets pretty good. And along comes somebody who says, hey, we've done everything. We've run the end. There was some, let me drop.
There was some very optimistic person or somewhere around 1910 who said a modern-day automobile, boy, it does everything. We're never going to get any better than this. You compare a 1910 automobile to a modern-day automobile with global positioning system inside and backup camera and automatic light adjusting and automatic braking. We've come a long way. And if you and I were optimistically saying, hey, the modern-day automobile does everything, we're never going to get any better than this, guarantee you'd be wrong. Over to you, David, KQIW.
KQIW from
KQ2RY.
Yeah, I think human beings, humankind, headed for some kind of infinite knowledge, you know, something much bigger, exponentially bigger than what we have now. And like what you're saying, you know, if you recognize that you can go further, you can go beyond. You know, you're sort of building on this idea that you're going to go much, much further, and we all benefit from that. Go ahead.
The good news, it usually gets better. Slowly. Paul, any other subject you want to discuss tonight during the space report portion of the TechNet? WS2N, K2IW. Mike, what's the next launch going to be, Paul?
Well, it'll be tomorrow. You can get to watch that on NASA TV. Watch the SpaceX launch Falcon 9 with the Dragon on top. Dragon will be going to the International Space Station, bring some 7,000 pounds worth of stuff. I mentioned that one earlier, and that should be good. The spacecraft itself is being reused. It's been up to the space station before, and so is the booster. The booster has been reused as well. And I think that booster is going to wind up going into the drink, and they'll probably let that go into the Atlantic Ocean. I thought about what I wanted to talk about with TESS. It's going to be going up, the 16th of this month, a couple of weeks from now. But it won't be operational for about 2 months. And the reason for that is it's going to take a long time to get to its proper orbit. It's going to be launched TESS will be launched from Launch Complex 40 in Florida. And that will be going on a 28-degree inclination plane. And it'll make four orbits, each orbit getting larger and larger until it gets to the orbit of the moon. And then when the moon does come around, this will be the only time it'll be set up like this. They're going to use the moon as a gravitational assist to change its inclination from this 28 degrees to a little over 40 degrees. And, you know, that moon will create that, they're going to the South Pole, will create that change. And then you'll be in what they call a transfer orbit, and then the next couple of orbits, they'll do a couple of propulsion thrust changes, and they'll wind up in this very large, almost like a 3-to-1 ratio for the orbit of the spacecraft itself around Earth, you know, a couple thousand miles, I think 6 or 7, maybe 10,000 miles away from the planet, from our planet, and then all the way out to the orbit of the moon over and over again. But to do all these orbital changes is going to take around 2 months, so they won't be able to, you know, get everything up and running and calibrated and everything until that 2 months pass. Back to you, Dick.
Need to be Troy. Why would another question, Paul?
Okay, we've got 7 minutes left. Fire away, Joe.
Okay, if one does not have access to NASA TV, do they stream that on maybe like from a video site or something, or a video page or a website Is that available like that? Like you'd have streaming audio, you'd have streaming video? Or was it just NASA TV? If you don't get it, you don't get it.
Yeah, I get it. Well, I have the NASA app. If you have a phone or a tablet, I have it on that. And then, you know, it's an actual TV app. And, you know, once you have it downloaded, you can click on it and you can bring up different things, different missions, whatever. And then the one in the middle will say, live TV or something like that. I forget the exact words. You know, you click on that middle one, you'll get the TV on your phone or tablet. Or on a regular computer, you can do it as well. And then if you're having trouble finding it, you can go to the NASA.gov website, NASA.gov, during the event, and they'll say, you know, live, whatever it might be, space launch or, you know, from Kazakhstan with a crew on it or, you know, a landing. You know, you click on that, and that'll bring you to NASA TV that way. So, that's the way I watch it. Back in the 1980s, they used to actually have NASA TV and watch it through cable TV, but they did away with it. Back to Joe. Yeah, I used to, when I had access to a satellite TV system, it was all available on one of the channels. I don't have access to that anymore. That's where those two videos this came from, with the shuttle launches. I thought they did that... you know, like over the web or something like that. So I'll have to check it out next time.
Yeah, it would be, I just brought it up, www.nasa.gov, and then they have /multimedia/NASA TV, then the pound sign, and then the word public, and that'll get you there. They're doing insights. A repeat of an Insight news conference right now. Insight's going up in May. That's the one going to Mars. So that's the story on that show.
Oh, okay. Very good. Thanks, Paul.
The Super Europa craft, sometime in the 2020s. I think Europa is covered with a very thick layer of ice, and they believe there's liquid underneath. Have they said what the Super Europa is going to measure and what method is going to use to do it, Joe? I mean, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I finally saw what this thing looks like. It's going to have 6 legs instead of 3 or 4, whatever. It's going to have 6 legs, and it plans on landing on the moon that way. And then it's got all kinds of detectors. They want to be able to detect life. The original plans was to have a battery, and it was going to last for 20 days. And they plan on transmitting up to the mothership, which would have been the Europa Clipper. So the idea is the Europa Clipper is going to go to Jupiter and go, it'll orbit Jupiter, but every time it goes past Europa, who's been going close by, and this will happen 40 different times over the years, and then that's when they'll get all the information, and then when they're away from Europa, they'll transmit the data back to Earth. Well, at the same time, they would have this lander down on Europa, and they would use the Europa Clipper that's going around 40 different times as a repeater system. But now they're changing that whole thought pattern. They're thinking we might have a completely different flight. One to Europa Clipper and another one just for the lander. Let me drop it. Make the lander bigger with these 6 legs now, and then also have these life-detecting gadgets on board, for, you know, their instruments. But instead of sending signals up to a repeater, have a bigger antenna, twice the size that they planned, and send the signals directly back to Earth. They think that whole system would be cheaper and a better way to go. And now with this 3.5
6 trillion, I think it was $6.3 trillion that was approved for the government to stay in business. Out of that, NASA now wound up with $21.5 billion instead of $19 billion. Now, they got $1.5 billion more, actually $1.6 billion more than they thought they were going to get last year. And now they're going to bring back this idea of the Europa Clipper. That'll stay on the books, but the lander, which was off the books, is now back on the books. And instead of using batteries, to transmit for 20 days, now they're thinking about having an RTG, because now NASA found out that the government is, by that time, will be making a lot more plutonium-238. So they'll take the plutonium-238 and use that for the RTGs, and, you know, they'll be able to have a very, very long-lasting craft sitting on the moon of Europa. That's the latest plan. If they do that, the Clipper will go up soon, you know, probably early 20s. But the lander would not be going and landing until 2031. So that's the latest on that. Back to you. WSOS.
That's quite a long time for you and I to wait. Okay. That was TechNet number 1693. That was Space Report number 293. That was Science and Physics Report number 23. 73, you all. See you next week. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye from me. And Roy and Paul, if you want to say any final comments, thank you for your participation. K2RIW Clear and listening.
Thank you, Dick. Paul, this is AC2GS. And once again, if anyone wants to volunteer any topics or questions or anything about science or physics or anything like that, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And thank you all for participating, and have a great week, guys and gals.
73, we'll be back next week. And Easter is over. Passover for some of you guys, and we're into another day. Let's hope it doesn't snow. 73 WS 2N will be clear.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear. Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. Repeater system.